Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2014. Lecture 3, delivered on January 21, 2014. The title of this lecture is Financial Markets and Interest Rates.
Today, financial markets and interest rates. Now, in the last lecture, I had gone a little ways into interest rates, and let me finish that little story up here for you. And then I'm going to step back into financial markets and tell you a few stories about financial markets. And then in your next lecture, I'm going to talk about the Federal Reserve, which is always a really thrilling topic. Really? Okay. And let me get you on the document camera. Actually, I should probably kill this front light here so you can see a little better. That's close enough. Okay, now I had written down, and this is just the review. The risk-free rate is the real rate of return. Oh, I was just testing you to see if you could. There. Fine, if you want to see it. Plus an expected inflation premium. Now, generally speaking, As far as the risk-free rate goes, it's not something that is actually out there, but things that are close to it are out there. For a long time, this risk-free rate was proxied by a short-term treasury bill. Interestingly, in more recent times, a lot of analysts, researchers, market participants have gone to a somewhat longer term 10-year treasury note. But for the purposes of this class, I would say, well, the yield on a treasury bill is, and then that would be the end of the story. I wouldn't go into the complexities of treasury notes or anything like that. But anyway, this is the heart and soul of every interest rate that sits out there. Somewhere embedded underneath the big number is this relatively small number. Now, the problem is that this, of course, fluctuates through time because of the supply and demand conditions of interest rates. The Federal Reserve manipulates that up and down, but also because of expected inflation. Now, the Federal Reserve can try to stimulate the economy by increasing the supply of money, which pushes this down. That's what's been happening for about going on 6 years now, 5.5 years, pushing that interest rate down by just flooding the market with as much money, quantitative easing is what they call it these days, as they can. That suppresses the case of real, and that will bring down the risk-free rate, and theoretically that brings down all interest rates and that boosts the economy. But unfortunately, eventually something takes over. Inflation. And now the inflation isn't the worst part. It's the expectation of inflation that is the killer. Because if you print money for too long, that is in the growth, if the growth rate of the money supply is greater than the real growth rate of the economy, you will get inflation. That's just the reality of it. Nothing else creates inflation. You hear these things, the minimum wage is going to go up and that's going to cause inflation. No, it won't. That's not how it works. All that would happen in that case is if there were a fixed money supply, you would see other factors of production being used more and all of that. But, and also, that industry jacked up its prices on cars. Well, that's going to be inflationary. No, it's not. It doesn't work that way. The only thing that creates inflation is an excess growth rate of the money supply over the real growth rate of the economy. Eventually, that becomes an expectation of inflation. And that is the real killer. Because eventually, once people expect the Fed to just keep pouring money in and pouring money into the economy, even when the Fed starts to drop mud in its diaper because inflation is going up, and it starts to cut the growth rate of the supply of money, the markets aren't going to believe it. Tell you a story. Back in the 60s, we came out of the 50s. We came out of an era where we had a president and a Congress that were austere. They said, all right, money supply grows at a fixed rate so that it just matches the real growth rate of the economy. In other words, we grow the money supply as the economy needs more money. No more, no less. And we didn't spend a whole lot of money on wars. We didn't spend a whole lot of money on social programs. And so Eisenhower, the last president of the 1950s, came out with a budget surplus. Unbelievable. Well, then we came into the era of Kennedy and the neo-Keynesians, and government has an active role in the economy. Grow it. Make it happen. Well, he was trying to get things going, but there was money being printed. We were beginning to get kind of adventuresome in Southeast Asia, and we were also beginning to talk about new programs, space program, social programs. And after Jack was killed, assassinated in Dallas in 63, Lyndon Johnson took over. There was kind of a belief among conservatives, well, thank God, he's a Democrat, but he's a Texas old blue dog, kind of guy who probably has a white sheet hanging in his closet somewhere. Interestingly enough, though, Johnson pursued the same activist policies as Kennedy did. And honestly, part of it was he had been Kennedy's vice president, and he said, we're just going to keep this going. This is what Jack wants. And all the old blue dogs in Congress, they thought he was going to be their boy. He wasn't. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, they weren't going to pass it, but he knew all the dirt on them, and he dragged them in one at a time, got them to pass that. Social welfare legislation. We also got into the Vietnam War heavily. Money was needed. And the money supply, the Fed, was fairly accommodative. And then we got into the Nixon years, and you know, you expect, well, he's a Republican, he's a conservative, he's going to clamp down, stop spending money. He didn't. And especially after the Arab oil embargo, which was a price shock, doesn't create inflation unless you print money to cover the shock, which he and the Federal Reserve at the time, sure enough, they printed money. And they started printing it at a faster and faster rate. You see, because as the markets got to expect this money, this excess money, it just was evaporating into inflation faster and faster. By the time we got to Gerald Ford, who was president for 2 years after Nixon resigned, it was getting to be a severe problem. It was a serious problem. Well, President Ford said, okay, we're going to have to get a slogan, whip inflation now. In other words, let's just stop having inflation. When? Well, unfortunately, that's not how it works. You have to stop printing money, and that's a shock to the economy. He wouldn't do it. Well, the Federal Reserve wasn't going to take that one on the chin. They were just not going to do it. And we came to the Carter years. And so Jimmy Carter knew there was an issue. Being highly educated, he grasped rather quickly what it was, but he also tried at first to get people to just stop being inflated. So, of course, Jimmy Carter, being not too astute at promoting things, his way of getting people to stop being inflation-oriented was the slogan that inflation was the moral equivalent of war. Unfortunately, the acronym for that is MEOW. Didn't go. So he knew what to do, though. In 79, he appointed a new chairman of the Federal Reserve, a big cigar-smoking virtual sociopath named Paul Volcker. He didn't care. He just came in and he cut the money supply. He just clamped it down. Now, people didn't believe it at first. So this is what the Fed's been saying for years and years. Yeah, we're going to get this inflation. We're going to clamp down on the money. And they never did. So at first, they didn't believe Paul Volcker was serious. So the expectation of inflation had already gone into the through the roof. And then the Fed cut the money supply down to the bone. Supply goes up. Supply goes down. Price goes up. We had interest rates going into the 1980 election that were insane. You're talking about mortgages at 25 and 30%, corporate bonds, coupons, 30%. Some of those 30-year bonds had just retired in the past few years. It was ridiculous. And, of course, interest rates went through the roof. The economy went into a tailspin of a recession shortly before the election of 1980. And, of course, that was enough to get Jimmy Carter kicked out of office, and he was replaced by Ronald Reagan, a governor of California and a former actor in Western movies. Well, eventually, as Volcker just kept his hand on the throat of the economy, finally, the markets began to believe him. The expectation of inflation began to drop down. Interest rates began to drop down from that. And also tax cuts that were initiated in Reagan's first year of office began to help a little bit. And finally, Volcker began to let off and let the money supply start growing at a normal rate. And we came into a relatively decent economic period. But that gives you an idea of that relationship between money supply, inflation, expected inflation, and how economies work. Inflation is the result of too much money chasing too few goods. That's just all there is to it. Okay, now that is the backdrop. But how do we get to the interest rates that we have in the real world? Car loan, home loan, student loan, corporate, a loan to a corporation so it can expand its operations. That's when you come to the next place. The interest rate that you will see on any instrument, regardless of what it is going to start with that baseline risk-free rate that underlies every interest rate, that whisper, that foundation. And then there's going to be something that is called the risk premium. The risk premium. Has three parts to it. Now, these interplay to create an actual interest rate. The three parts are the default premium, the maturity premium, and the illiquidity premium, which I designate K sub L. K sub D plus K sub M plus K sub L. Now, some instruments have a very high default premium. In other words, there's a good chance that part or all of the obligation will not be satisfied. The maturity premium is a reward to the lender for longer-term instruments. And I'll get back to that in a minute here. And the illiquidity, I used to call it the liquidity premium. Your book calls it the illiquidity premium, so I'll try to stick to that. The illiquidity premium is the reward if this is the kind of instrument that would be hard for the lender to unload to someone else. So let me go through. The default premium is the premium that is there that rewards the lender, for the possibility that part or all of the loan will not be satisfied. So let's go through a couple of different ones. How about a student loan? Would it have a high or a low default premium? It would have a relatively low. We'll get back to why that would be in a minute here. What about a home loan? Would that have a high default premium or a low default premium?
Low.
Why? Stable investment for whom?
For the most part, for the purchaser.
There's more to it than that, but you're right. It would be something that you would not want to just give up very quickly. You would do whatever you could. You'd sell your cats. You'd sell some kids. Try not to go into bankruptcy. Unfortunately, a lot of people did. and they still are. The evil entity of the universe, Bank of America, is an engine of seizing properties people can't pay on. But even at that, you see, the lender has several things going in favor of it, even if you default. First of all, the lender gets the house. There's a hard asset that they can get rid of, they can dispose. Follow that? So even though you default, they get the house, they can sell it. And then there's something most people don't even know about. It's mortgage interest. When you take out a loan, if it has a loan-to-value ratio above 80%, you have to pay an insurance premium that makes the lender whole if you default. So in other words, if there's a differential between what the loan value is and what the house is worth, the lender gets repaid by an insurance company called, and the one that's big in the business is called MAGIC, the Mortgage Assurance Guarantee Corporation. In other words, you are paying an insurance premium. Most people don't even know they're paying it. And even more, most people pay it for the entire life of the loan, even though they are required by law to pay it only for while the loan-to-value ratio is above 80%. A lot of people just pay their loan payment every month for years and years, not realizing that there's a darn nice little chunk of that payment that is a mortgage insurance premium they're paying for the lender to be covered if they go into default and they don't have to pay it after you go below LTV of 80%. Interesting little sidelight you almost never hear about. The poor put upon lenders who are suffering because all these damn people default on their mortgages, they're not being hurt as much as you might think they are. They've got the house to sell, and they've got a mortgage insurance policy paid for by the people that they took the house from that covers their ass for the differential between the loan's face value and what they finally get it off their REL, real estate owned books at. So anyway, okay, so home loans should have a low default premium, and you do see those interest rates not being that bad. What about a car loan? High or low?
High.
A little bit higher. Not horribly high, but it would be higher than a home loan. The most important reason is because when you buy a new car, as soon as you drive it off the lot, it loses a lot of its value. It loses a serious chunk of value. So even if it's repoed, the lender is not going to get as much out of it as they lent on it. Pretty much guaranteed that's the case. And there's no insurance like there is for mortgages. So they get kind of cooked. That's why a car loan will tend to have a higher interest rate for the most part than a home. There's more of a loss there. What would be something that would have a high interest rate? Can you think of something that has a high interest rate? You might not at your age. Oh, God, yes. Oh, God, those vultures, predators, sons of bitches. I love them. I use them all the time. But, those, because there's such a high risk of default on the loan, such a high. And but there's also the elasticity of demand thing. Because the people who need those kinds of loans are going to be almost immune to high interest rates because they're so desperate for a loan. So there's that in those interest rates as well. Another one that has high interest rates, credit cards. Have you seen the rates on credit cards? You know, it's like 18% plus stupid. It's ridiculous because they have a high default rate. There's a serious default rate on those. Let me go on to the maturity premium. This is a reward for extended period of lending. And the longer the loan is, the worse this premium is going to be. Here's why. You are going to borrow money from me. I'm the lender, I'm a bank, and you are going to borrow on a home loan. Okay, so let's say that you borrow at 8%. Okay. In, let's say, 2 years, let's say 5 years, interest rates fall to 4%. What are you going to do?
Call the bank.
Call the bank and do what? Well, do you know what that term is, what the term for that is? You're going to refi. Once the interest rates fall, you're going to refi on me. So I was expecting 30 years of 8% lending. You're going to flip all that loan, give me back my original money, maybe go to another bank, whatever, and I will no longer be able to get my 8%. My expectation for 30 years was 8%. Well, I got that for 5 years, and then from there, you pay me back my money. I can lend it out only at 4%. So I get cooked if interest rates fall. Now, here's the other side of it. What happens if interest rates rise? You got an 8% loan, and interest rates go up to 18%, 20%. You were planning to sell that house in 7 years, 10 years, and get a bigger house because you now have 12 kids. Fertile young stud, weren't you? Okay, are you going to do that now? Borrow, buy a new house, borrow again at 20%? Oh, hell no. You see, most people hold on to their houses for maybe about 7 years, but they'll hold on to them much longer if interest rates are 20%. I lent you 8% money. Boy, would I love to have that money back so I could lend it back out at 20%. But you conniving capitalist SOB, you're going to hold on. You got an 8% loan in a 20% environment? You're going to hold on to that thing. You see, so I get burned either way. If interest rates go down, you'll refi. If interest rates go up, you're not going to move from that house. You're just going to keep paying that cheapo 8% when I would really love to have that money back so I could lend it out at 20%. So in either case, interest rates are going to burn me, the lender. And the longer the term of the loan is, the more likely interest rates will do something up or down. In other words, as time goes on, there's more of a chance that volatility is normal, natural volatility is going to act to burn my butt as the lender. So the maturity premium gets worse the longer the term of the loan. That's why when you get a 20-year mortgage, you'll get a lower interest rate than you will with a 30-year mortgage. That's purely, well, not purely, but it's most of it, is the maturity premium differential. Because there's less likelihood of an adverse movement in interest rates for the lender in 20 years than there is in 30 years. And the last one, the liquidity premium. Almost no traditional kind of loan, regardless of what it is anymore. Well, I got to be careful about that. Most loans actually don't stay with the lender more than maybe a few days or a few hours. You borrow money from a bank for a home, you get a mortgage, that bank is going to sell that mortgage to a secondary mortgage market. They're going to package it up with a bunch of other ones they've made that day or that week, and they're going to trot them out the door, and they will be bought up by these massive institutions like the Ginnie Mae and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, all that kind of stuff. So these loans have to be of a quality so that they can be moved into one of these secondary mortgage markets, as they're called. Credit cards, this is the case, home loans, even student loans, Sallie Mae. You got a loan from a bank for your student loan, it was gone into the secondary mortgage market, packaged up with a bunch of other student loans into a big bundle, and it was sold into the secondary mortgage market called Sallie Mae. And Sallie Mae just mooshes them all together and then squeezes them and pulls them apart into different structures of cash flows. And then huge investors around the world, from Japan and China to the big trusts and insurance companies in the United States, they buy up the big oozing instruments, or the pieces of them. The bank still services the loans almost always. You'll send your loan payment to them, and they get a little fee for taking in the money and sending it on to the people who actually own your loan. The problem is that there are some kinds of financial securities that are not easy to unload quickly. Think of it this way. Find someone. Army?
Yes, sir.
What's your MOS?
We don't get to pick until after college.
Are you sure you'll get to pick? Okay. Well, let's try this. Now, this is a fine, upstanding young soldier. He has high credentials. He comes from a great family. And he chose, instead of going on to corporate America first, he decided that he would serve his country. So here's the thing, though. You see, you want to borrow $100. You want to borrow some money. Let's just say you want to borrow some money. Now, I, on the other hand, am a street person. I look sort of like a Yeti, except that the Yetis won't take credit for me. And the two of us both need money. Now, both of us will pay you back $100 in 1 year. We both are promising you that. Now, he comes to you with this nice parchment piece of paper, wherefore I shall borrow from you this amount of money, and I'll pay you back at this rate, and I will protect this investment with my father's signature, and he's very important. And what I do is I'm going to write on an IOU on a piece of napkin I found in the trash. Yeah, I owe you $100 in 1 year. Here's a goddamn paper. Yeah. Now, which one of us are you going to lend more to? Him. You might lend him $90, $95. Me, I'm going to be lucky if you give me coffee money. Okay, elitist bastard that you are. You see, if you really needed money in that year, you could probably, at maybe 6 months, you could sell it to someone else, this nice paper that's notarized and signed and all that, maybe for $97. There's no way you're going to unload that napkin on anyone. No one's going to buy that from you and say, I'll take on that debt with that Yeti. You see, that's the liquidity premium. That it would be very hard to unload this thing of mine that you're holding. It would be very easy to unload that thing of his. When I ran a penny stock house many years ago, the thing was that these were bad risks, incredibly difficult to sell. The raising the money for them was the first hard thing. And then you have the stock you would give to the investors who would put money into it. And then you had this sort of very thin line of market makers. And they'd say, okay, we got someone called in and said that he wants to sell his 10,000 shares of this common stock of this penny stock corporation. And there was no way you could immediately find a matching buyer. 10,000 shares of this crap, I would probably have to work for months to find some sucker or some investor who would buy that up to match the sell with a buy. And so that was one of the reasons the prices were so low, because people who bought it, they were sitting there, and if they tried to unload it, it was going to take months if they ever. Many times the company went bankrupt before a sell order could be executed for them, which really pissed them off. But there you go. That's that same idea of that liquidity premium sneaking in with penny stocks. Things that are easy to unload, yeah. There's almost no liquidity premium. But things that are hard to unload, you're probably going to have the liquidity premium being as bad, if not worse, than the default premium on that kind of stuff. So there you are. Those are the risk premia. And they play, sometimes one's high, the others are low, sometimes they're all high. It's all over the place. But that explains why you see different interest rates in the real world. Now, I want to bring up a couple of points here, a couple of things, just terminology, real quick. Get these definitions down, and as I have warned you in the past, for God's sake, definitions, don't go to Wikipedia, Investopedia, Stupidopedia, or anything like that. Come to your uncle here, your funny uncle, maybe, but your uncle, okay? Because the people who do things like Wikipedia, they don't know shit. They are creepy, weird-ass people who do this because they are obsessed with it. Investopedia, they have special interests. They have interest in having you see things in specific ways, and sometimes they way oversimplify. Follow with me on a couple of things here. I want to, first of all, get out the concept of money. And this is an important one right off the bat. Woman, what's money? Well, yeah, that's not bad. Yeah. Anything else about money?
Green currency.
Oh, stop it. You seen the new money that's being issued?
Fancy.
Yeah. You know what else is creepy about it? I put up a poster. I put up one of each of the new denominations of money, and under it, I put up the same denomination of Monopoly money. The colors match. Swear to God. Really? You know, Fed, can you be a little bit less crass about this stuff that you're printing these days? The colors match. You know, I looked at it and I thought, the fuck? Anyway, here we go. Money is anything that is accepted in exchange for something else. Money is anything that is accepted in exchange for something else. Now, I could slide in there, and you might want to put in the word generally accepted for something else. So in other words, you have hit the skids. This degree turned out to be not really worth anything for you, and so you finally realized that you were going to have to, yes, sell your body on the streets. But it didn't start that way. I mean, it was just you were in the Navy. And it was lonely one night, and it was a dark alley, and you heard this blues music in the background, and there I was. And I said, hello, sailor. Right to the YMCA. Look, the thing, though, is that I teach you the ropes, I show you how to do this, and your specialty is being cougar bait. Your money, you're accepted. Your services are, and we know your services are very good. Real finance for real people. Okay, your money. I need work done on my car, and you've heard that I make the best damn apple pie in the 5-county area, and you like apple pie. And so I say, I need a tune-up on my car, and you say, well, I'd like a couple of apple pies. And that's generally what people take for services they provide to me. And so those apple pies are money. Money is a concept that we're locked into this, that it's got to be that green stuff. It doesn't have to be. Right now, there is a quiet revolution happening in the concept of money. Have any of you ever heard of Bitcoin? Yeah, that's money. And there's nothing tangible. It's not there. It's in electrons flipping around and all that. But it is so serious as money now because it is generally accepted, at least in some places, in some venues, that investment brokerage houses are creating stockpiles of it. The government raided this big site that had all kinds of Bitcoin paid for services like assassinations and stuff like that. They didn't give a rat's ass about the assassinations. What they wanted to do was get their hands on all those billions of Bitcoins and claim them for themselves. So now those Bitcoins are in the treasury. You see, that's when you know it's serious, is when governments start collecting Bitcoins. China is obsessed with collecting Bitcoins. That's money, and there's nothing there. It's just electronic blips. So money is whatever we want it to be. Now, let me give you three different types of money. There is barter money, There is metal, or sometimes you'll hear me use the term commodity money. And then there is fiat money. Now, barter money, the thing characteristic of these is the extent to which the money itself can be consumed. Barter money. Barter. You are a moose maker, a moose killer, a moose hunter. Okay, real butch. I mean, it's a butch thing. And of course, I make apple pies. So you see, you come to me one day and you say, I've got a moose. Do you have pie? I said, yes, I do. Moose for 5 apple pies? Let's make it 7 apple pies. Okay, but are you going to throw in the fur, or are you going to take that back with you? I've heard you try to pull that off and then say it's a bald moose. Don't play that game with me, okay? And we make an agreement. Now, in that case, there's barter money, because you can eat moose and use its fur, and you can eat the apple pies, and then keep the, I really wish you would return those tin pans that I put, but no. Okay, so there's barter money. You can eat, you can use it, you can actually consume it, all of it. Now, metal money, or commodity money, still has that quality that it is usable, but it's not as usable. It's really, a lot of it depend upon, well, sort of fads. Gold comes in and out of style. I've got gold coins. That means I'm safe from the zombie apocalypse. Well, not really, because if gold goes out of fashion as an acceptable form of exchange, it won't work. It won't be a good money anymore. And you say, well, gold will always be in style. Guess what? You can't do a whole lot with gold. Gold is a soft metal. It doesn't work to make a lot of things. You can use it in microcircuits, but during the zombie apocalypse, who's going to be building microcircuits? You're too busy worrying about cardio, the double tap, and all that. For those who know Zombie Land. And Twinkies. Okay, but there are metals. Interestingly, you will see that at certain times in history, like, for example, during our Civil War, metal money was melted down to make musket balls. You did what you had to do to survive and to fight. And at other times, we find from ancient times, spearheads, metal arrowheads and spearheads. And if you look carefully, you see that there is inscription. Well, what's that? Oh, it was once a coin, and when the crap got real, they hammered the coins down into hard points for weapons. So metal can be used. It's not as useful as things that you can eat, but the metal monies do have a consumability. It's just not as high as barter money. Now, where the line is, it's kind of hard to say. Fiat money is money that is by decree only. It has no intrinsic value. No intrinsic value. So, this is fiat money, a dollar bill. It exists only, it is accepted only because we are ordered to accept it by the federal government. It says on the front, where the hell? Did I get a phony dollar or what? Oh, there it is. This piece of paper, this piece of crap, is good for all debts, public and private. In other words, by law, you have to take it. You cannot refuse it. And that's its only use. You can't use this for anything. Well, I guess you could use it for toilet paper, but then your ass would smell weird. But other than that, it has no real intrinsic value whatsoever. Okay? And so that's fiat money. Fiat money just exists because we are ordered by the king, the sovereign, to accept it, or by someone who could kill us if we don't, or hurt us. and that's the only reason that it exists. Now, you might hear, well, that's why we need to go back to a gold standard and all that. Oh, bull crap. The problem is that whatever standard you use, it is merely that because the base currency is that merely because we say it is. We accept it. So whether it is a fiat money or a gold or a silver or whatever or a Bitcoin is entirely dependent upon us saying, okay, I'll take that in exchange for something. That's all there is to it. Now, I mentioned the idea of liquidity. Liquidity is the ease with which you can convert an asset into cash or into something that you can eat, maybe. That might be even a little better. So the most liquid instrument we can talk about right now is the dollar. It's highly liquid. Money is, this fiat money is the most liquid thing out there. The only thing that is a close substitute in terms of liquidity are short-term treasury bills of the United States government. They are as liquid. There's one little defect in a treasury bill that makes it not exactly a perfect substitute for fiat money. But at the same time, at the scale of high liquidity, there's the fiat money we call the American dollar. And then right there in that same league are U.S. short-term U.S. Treasury instruments. Now let me get something going here. If I can. Liquidity. Sorry, liquidity. Okay. Now, I use the word money, and I think I might have mentioned this last time, but let me make sure you know that when I use the term money, I am technically referring to an asset that is very short term, 1 year or less. So in other words, when you want to borrow for 90 days, you are accessing the money markets. If I want money for more than a year, I would be accessing the capital markets. So when you buy a 3-year CD, you are providing money to the capital markets for use. If you buy commercial paper from a large creditworthy corporation, then you are accessing, then you are providing funds to the money market. Now, in terms, did I just have a stroke? Oh. No, I'm a smoker. When the lights go dim, that means it's time for a blood vessel to start squirting in my brain. The hell? Oh, that really helped. Is there some reason why this sucks? There. I knew that. I knew what I was doing there. Okay. Look. Oh, yeah. I need to bring up a couple of other terms here. Madam, I want to borrow money from you. Okay? You lend me some money, I pay you back $100. Okay? Now, in a case like that, I'll write out an IOU for you. I am the seller of the debt instrument. You are the buyer. In other words, the borrower is the seller. The lender is the purchaser. The price you pay is the amount you lend me. You follow with that? It's different from what you think, but in this case, because I have got this note, and I'm going to this thing, and I'm going to give it to you. You give me money in exchange. You are actually paying the price of the amount borrowed. So I'm selling. I'm the seller. You're the buyer. So when you borrow money from a bank for a home, you are actually the issuer the seller of the promissory loan agreement. You are the issuer. Well, you might think to yourself, well, no, because they've got the paperwork. No, all they're doing is they're writing it up on your behalf. That's all they're doing, just to make sure that it's exactly the way they want it in order for them to buy it from you for the loan amount that they're providing. That's a different way of thinking about it from how we, you know, in the common world, we don't think about our loans working that way. But that's how they are. Borrowers are issuers, sellers. Lenders are buyers, purchasers. Again, let me repeat that. Borrowers are issuers, sellers of the security. Lenders are the buyers, the purchasers of the securities. Now let's talk about debt. There are three kinds of debt that we would want to bring up here. Three kinds of debt. I keep looking at that clock and it's freaking me out. They never changed it from daylight savings time, so I keep thinking it's time to dismiss the class. Wrong. Unless one of you changed it to that. Okay. I want to distinguish among a bill, a note, and a bond. A bill is less than 1 year, less than or equal to, I say. Since a treasury bill is an instrument where the government is borrowing money from you for a certain period of time that would be less than a year, and then they pay you back. A note is between 1 year and 7 years. And a bond is more than 7 years, more than 7 years. So if you borrow money to buy a house, you are the issuer of a bond. The bank is the buyer of the bond. If you buy, what about a car loan? What would that be?
A note.
Usually it's between 3 and 6 years. So that is, you are issuing a note, and the bank that lends you the money is the buyer of the note. The purchase price they give you, well, they give the dealer, is how much a car costs. And then, of course, these bills, this is where it really begins to get a little weird, is you see, well, I got a bill from the electric company. Well, actually, no. You issued the bill. All they're doing is sending you a memorandum about what you issued. You see, you're borrowing electricity from the electric company, and they accumulate the debt, and then every 30 days or so, they ask for you to satisfy the debt. But you're the one who is issuing the debt. I got a bill in the mail. Well, that was your bill. They just reminded you of it with a piece of paper to tell you how much you had borrowed from them for 30 days. That's how it sounds like a kind of a nonsense distinction, but it's important to know it and know that these things that are out there are what the terminology really means. So going back here, I want you to do me a favor. Right at the top of this, I want you to read me what is at the very top of that piece of fiat money.
Federal Reserve note?
Federal Reserve note. So what do you know? You know it was issued, it was, came from the Federal Reserve. What else do you know about it now? What else do you know? What did you just say? Federal Reserve note. So what do you know? What? When I'm being mean to you. It's complicated. What do you say? What am I? It's a Federal Reserve note. So what does that mean? It is due in what period of time? 1 to 7 years. In other words, this would have to be paid back in 1 to 7 years. So essentially what this is a borrowing. Who's the borrower here? Does anyone know who the borrower is?
Would it be the government?
Yes. And acting through its agent, the Federal Reserve. And so, in other words, this is actually borrowed money borrowed by the government, with the Federal Reserve creating the paper that the government is issuing. And then they say, use this for your day-to-day transactions. And then we will retire this. We will retire this, the government says, in 1 to 7 years. Okay, how do they retire it? Retirement means you pay it off. How do they retire it? How does government pay it off? Do you know? Okay. Who's going to work for this? I can't use a girl for this one. I'll have to use you. Okay? Okay. Open your mouth. And go. They grind it up. And then you know what they do? They print another one. In other words, they pay off this one with another one just like it. Maybe a couple more just like it, if they want to grow the money supply. Wouldn't that be cool? You borrow money, and when you have to pay it off, you just print more of it to pay it off. That's what this is. That's what it means to be the sovereign. As the movie said, it's great to be king. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Let me talk about interest rates here. Is there any way we could find out what the economy is going to do over? Wouldn't it be great if you knew what was going to happen as far as the economy goes? That would be a nice thing to do. Well, we don't have a crystal ball, but there are things we can see about what the market expects the economy to do. Now, remember I said that interest rates are the price of money, and you can see all kinds of nuances and risk premium and all that. Well, for one thing, if we're talking about the government and the short-term borrowings, those would be treasury bills. The intermediate-term borrowings, those would be treasury notes. And the long-term borrowings of the government, that would be treasury bonds. Well, you know, those would be kind of an interesting way to see what the markets think the economy is doing by seeing yield spreads on the different kinds of instruments. But before I do that, I'm going to show you an interesting principle about treasury, and treasury bills are the perfect way to show it. When the government issues most debt instruments of corporations, not like consumer debt, government and corporations, when they issue debt, they will pay the interest on it for the years that it's out there. And then they'll pay off the face value at the end of the life of the debt obligation. That's not like how we consumers, we have to pay part of the principal along the way. But corporations and government don't do it that way. All they do is pay the interest on the debt. In other words, they service the debt, but they don't amortize it. That all happens at the very end, they pay off the face value. If I don't say otherwise, the face value of every corporate and government instrument is $1,000. It is always denominated as $1,000 unless it's something weird. Remember that. Face value is $1,000. So let's talk about a treasury auction where there are treasury bills on the table. Literally, many years ago, there would have been a table. There would have been a physical auction location. But now it's all electronic and all that. Okay, so let's go back to the old days. Back to the old school from years and years ago. And so what we're going to do is we're going to run a treasury auction where there are treasury bills that are being sold. Now remember, a treasury bill will pay you $1,000 in 1 year. This one will be different from any other one because this will be a discount instrument. You'll buy it for something less than $1,000, and in exactly 1 year, you'll get $1,000. That's how discount instruments work. So here we go. We're going to take this down the road here. You have come to the Treasury auction. You're just kind of kicking tires. Now, I am the waitress at the Treasury auction. My name is Mabel. Well, how are you doing there, young man? Are you looking for a Treasury bill? Oh, my, you're such a strapping young hunk of beef. Let's see if we can find you a nice, pretty Treasury bill. Oh, this one is really nice, yeah. Well, these are going very fast here. What would you, you remember, you get $1,000 back in 1 year. Right now, we're selling them for $975. Would you like to buy one? My ass. Say it. Yes. Say it. It's $975 and you get $1,000 back in a year. The government is good for it. You know, it's like I said, we won't default. We'll just attack another country and pillage it for the money. $975. Earl, put one in a bag. We got a nice young man here. Here you go. Here's your Treasury bill. That'll be $975. So let's talk about what happens with the yield on this. So we have a Treasury bill. Now we're going to have the price of it. We're going to have the face value. We're going to have the dollars of interest you make. And then we're going to have the yield. This is how we calculate it. Okay. The price you paid is $975. Get a calculator out. Make sure you have your calculator. Now, the face value in 1 year, exactly 1 year, is going to be $1,000. And always that will be the case, $1,000. I don't have to tell you that. It's $1,000. Oh, sorry about that. That's all one column there. Well, hell. This was someone's term paper. It looks like it actually was. Price, face, dollar interest, yield. Okay. Make sure I'm on the page here. Okay, the price is $975. The face is $1,000. So at the end of 1 year, how much interest do you get? How much did you get in dollar interest? $25. $25. So now it's exactly 1 year, so I can calculate the annual yield very easily. The annual yield will be how much you made, $25, over what? If you say $1,000, I will eat your ass. You invested $975. Don't ever put $1,000 in that denominator. I will put it as a multiple choice possibility. I will burn you. I will catch you. Don't fall into the trap. You invested $975 and got $25 in interest. Now, what's 25 divided by 975? What did that come out to be?
0.026.
Give it to me two decimal places as a percentage. 0.256, right? 2.56%. Okay? Is that right? Okay. In this class, two decimal places, always. House rules. Wherever you go to work, they'll have a house rule. Here, two decimal places, always, of accuracy. After you've turned it into a percentage in this case, of course. Yield was 2.56%. Okay, now, that worked out pretty well for you. So 1 year later, here you are back at the auction. Oh, my goodness, you came back. You got your $25 in the mail. You got your face value. Well, I'm so happy for you. There you go. Well, now you want another one, don't you? Oh, that's very nice. I'm just so glad to see returning customers. You're such a handsome man. Why don't you have a girlfriend, or do you teach at Penn State? Too soon? Too soon? Too soon? Okay, there we go. You look around the room, you know, you say, you know what? Last year was really crowded here, but this year it's not so crowded. What are you saying to me? Well, if there aren't as many people wanting those Treasury instruments, what are you going to say with my $975 ask? All think. Be predatory. Be harsh, cruel. There aren't as many people here.
Yeah.
So I'm saying 975, what do you come back with?
Like 900?
Oh, that's a lot. What the hell? 950. Come on, 950. 950. That's scary. 900, that would be, yeah, that would be back at Jimmy Carter, why Jimmy Carter got kicked out of office. Okay, so this time, let's say the price is 950. Okay, so the yield, the face is still what? Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Makes me feel like I need to wash. In a year, how much did I, what, is there, do I have a defect there? Okay, there. So how much interest? In 1 year, you get $1,000. So what's your dollar interest that you pulled? 50. So now, how do I calculate yield? Tell me what to do here. 975? 950. Ha, I got you. I got your ass. You thought you knew it, didn't you? No. And what do you get? I always wrote 975. Don't do that. What do you come up with? Well, spank me, Jesus. When the price went down, the yield went up. That is one of the most fundamental principles of finance. Price goes down, yield goes up. That's the driving force. If you hear bond prices went down today, that means that yields on them are pulling upward. That's kind of scary for an economy to have that happen. If prices go up, then bond prices go down. Then bond yields go down. That's why the Federal Reserve goes into the markets and buys and buys and buys treasury bills and treasury notes and all that from banks, is because that pushes the prices up, which pushes the yields down, which makes the interest rates in the whole economy lower, which is supposed to stimulate investment. We'll do that on Thursday for the most part, but there's one last thing I want to show you here. Is this little thing right here. I go back to just interest rates. And I said, wouldn't it be nice if you were able to predict markets and see what's going on? Well, that kind of sucked. What the heck? There. Okay. I'm going to show you something. This is called a yield curve. Well, you know what? There. It shows the yield against the time to maturity of government securities. In other words, we're stripping out default premium, illiquidity premium, and the only thing that would be in there is a maturity premium, but also a building expected inflation premium. Now, we love to have an upward arc to it. That's just a nice show that over time, there's some risk of volatility. And so we should typically expect these to go up. If they go up too strongly, that probably means that there is an expected inflation premium building in the long instruments. Even worse than that, though, is something called an inverted yield curve, where it goes up, but somewhere along its path, it dips down for some ways. Sometimes it'll just dip down. Sometimes it'll dip and then come back up. Every recession has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. But not every inverted yield curve has had a recession happen after it. But let's look at time. Let's see what was happening a long time, quite a few months ago. As we get closer to now, you notice that this flat part right in here began to take an arc. It began to lift upward. See it? Well, let's try that again. You know what? Is there some reason this sucks? Oh, there we go. That I know, right? Tells you what they think of me, the condemned building. Go ahead, teach it there, Craig. Okay, watch. You see how that dip that was disappearing, that's actually kind of a healthy sign, because that was kind of a little bit of a thing there. But look at this. Do you see that arc that was coming up there? And now, look at that. You see the how it's beginning to flatten? As a financial economist, that's something that I start to watch because I see the movement toward an inverted yield curve. Doesn't mean it's going to happen, but it's a sweat right now. Look how that thing is beginning to pull back down at the long end. It's beginning to drop. That's a quick little dirty way you can keep an eye on the economy and know whether you're going to have a job or not when you graduate. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.